Good morning, Portland, Maine. You're listening to Tad Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB 1310 AM and WLOBRadio.com. How are we doing, Deb?
Good. How are you?
Fantastic. Normally, we spend kind of a preamble talking about on this day and basic gibberish and what's new in your life and what's new in mine.
Right.
But we taped a few days ago an interview with a very interesting guest, so we will... We should really go right to that taped interview.
Sure. Yep.
We sat down with gentleman Paul Andrew Majewski. He is the director of UMaine Climate Institute. Basically, he heads up climate research and expeditions and the academic side of it up at UMaine, and it was a great interview. So let's go to that. Thank you again for listening to Tide Smart Talk, and here's our interview. Welcome back to Tad Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. Please join me in welcoming our guest, Paul Andrew Majewski. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you?
Paul is the director of UMaine Climate Institute, which is something near and dear to my heart. I suppose, to be fair to you, Paul, I need to warn you that on this side of the glass, you and I in the studio, I was going to say we're men of math and science, but I flunked both, but I believe in math and science. On that side of the glass, Deb, not Emily, but Deb, she's not a believer.
Okay.
And so I talk about climate change all the time. And, you know, they say that when you're speaking, you know, doing public speaking, you know, pick one person in the audience and if you can connect with them. For 3 years, I've been trying to connect with Deb on this issue. That may be futile. So I want to warn you, because you're a guest here, Deb has this whole thing where, you know, differentiating between weather and climate and change and heat. And so just want to be a fair host, because I believe that what's going on in terms of climate change is the most compelling issue that we're facing, not just in Maine or in the U.S., but in terms of obviously the Earth and what's happening. And our life is dependent on climate conditions, and it ties into food source and agriculture and all that. So let's, you know, it's unusual to kick off an interview by saying the person on the other side of the glass will represent the, what do we call your perspective on this, Deb?
The other side, maybe?
Crazy talk?
Oh, yes, crazy talk, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, anyhow, before we start, again, I almost want to repeat myself. We've got Paul Andrew Majewski here. He is the director of UMaine Climate Institute. Before we start talking about climate change and all that, if you wouldn't mind giving just a brief background, your background, where you grew up, your education, and then we'll talk a little bit of what is the UMaine Climate Institute, and then we'll talk about some specific issues of climate.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I was born in Edinburgh, Scotland. We moved to the U.S. when I was quite young. I did a lot of my schooling through high school in New York City. Then I went on to various state universities to get my degrees, eventually my PhD. I have spent a large portion of my career, which is about 45 years, leading expeditions all over the world to remote parts of the world. Some of the expeditions have been very large, 21 countries involved in covering large parts of Antarctica. Others have been multidisciplinary climate and a variety of other things. We work in very remote places. One of my greatest thrills is to be able to take students and introduce them to remote environments in the world. The whole purpose for it is to understand how the climate has changed, both because of natural causes and also because of what humans have done. As of 2000, I came to the University of Maine and started directing the Climate Change Institute. We are now relatively large for a climate research organization. We have about 130 people, of which about a little more than half are graduate students. The rest are faculty and staff. We are one of the oldest organizations in certainly the Western Hemisphere that has been studying climate. And we do it in many different ways. We look at the physical, the chemical, the biological, and the social aspects of climate change. And I should emphasize that when we talk about climate change, we don't necessarily use it in the common public term, which is referring only to what's happening today. We're really interested in how the whole system operates. And of course, with great emphasis on how humans have impacted it, and with our ultimate goal, coming up with better and better predictions for the future.
So when you talk about UMaine and 130 people, and many of them graduate students, are they folks from multiple disciplines in terms of folks that study the ocean, atmosphere, geology, or are these people full-time just focused on the climate?
Both. Some are studying to be climatologists. Some are biologists who are interested in how climate impacts biology. Some of them are anthropologists or social scientists who are studying the way civilization has evolved, the way people react to things. And, of course, one of the biggest things is how climate has affected civilization before humans actually started making big changes. There were dramatic collapses of civilizations that were directly related to natural variability in the climate system. Today, things are even more stressed than they have ever been in the past, and we're only in the early stages of that stress.
We have Paul Andrew Majewski here. He's director of UMaine Climate Institute. Where does the UMaine Climate Institute either rank or, for other context, how many university systems are here in the U.S. have similar programs or have similar groups dedicated? Is Maine near the top in terms of being active, or is it something that in academia there's a lot of activity and focus in this area?
There is more and more focus on climate and climate change throughout all academic institutions, government organizations, and industry, without a doubt. We have a very well-defined niche that we have held for a long time, putting us in the very top number of organizations in the world that study this. And our niche is not only to look at how the climate system operates today, which is to look at recorded information and satellite data, not only to be monitoring changes that are going on, not only to be developing models to understand how the future might evolve, but our biggest contribution has really been to go back in time, clearly more than 100 years prior to the time when we really have recorded records, in order to be able to see what is the full dynamic range of the climate system. We do it in many different ways. My specialty involves ice cores, but other people look at lake sediments, how glaciers have fluctuated. And it is critically important to have perspective. If you know how much the climate changed in the past, and how whether or not you are on an upward or a downward trend, how fast those changes occur, you can make much better predictions than you can if you only have the last 100 years of, in some cases, relatively sparse recorded record.
So when you talk about ice core, you're also talking about research involving isotopes and the technology that now exists, being able to really look back beyond 100 years, 1,000 years, but thousands of years. So, you know, the more context you have and the more layers you go down, and I think the science has gotten in the technology for that analysis has gotten much more advanced in the last decade or so, right?
It absolutely has. We, in fact, have been a large part of that advance. In the last couple of years, well, let me back up a little bit. We can absolutely go back 100,000 years. We're looking at changes in climate and things like CO2 that go back 500,000, arguably a million years is the latest record that we're working on. Our technology has changed dramatically. We can now look at a 100,000-year ice core that is 10,000 feet long and treated like a giant tree core, where you can not only count the annual layers, and as you go deeper and deeper into the ice, they get more and more squashed, but we can literally look at the storm events which make up those yearly and seasonal signals. We're the only lab in the world that can do this. To give you an idea of what we're able to do, in a place where a normal laboratory might be able to potentially identify a year, in some cases we can get 500 to 1,000 samples that define that year. So it's literally more than daily sampling.
Interesting. But before, I want to get into the science, and I want to talk about also what else is going on in UMaine in terms of the research. But before we go too deep, I also want to talk about the political climate relative to either acceptance or denial. And, you know, we're entering earlier and earlier in the, you know, the cycle of presidential cycle where it hasn't come up quite a bit in this last, you know, everybody's hearing about the Donald, right? Deb follows the Donald religiously. He's doing excellent, by the way, giving out cell phone numbers, and he is really doing something. But sooner or later, the issue of climate comes up, all the candidates. Out of the 130 folks that are part of the UMaine Climate Institute, my guess, and again, it's going to be a leading question, and you can either kind of agree or disagree. My guess is, since most of the folks are scientists, most of the people work in academia, most of the people are committed to research, that out of those 130 people, there aren't really political agendas. They aren't, you know, when you sit down at your group meetings or subgroup meetings or you're leading an expedition to Antarctica, you don't ask people to raise their hands. How many Democrats do we have here? How many Republicans? It's really about the science. And I don't want to oversimplify or diminish the importance, but it's really smart, really dedicated scientists with pocket protectors with pens who are just focusing on the science. And my sense is there's no real political filter. There's no real, for people doing this work, they're just focused on math and science or the environment or something else. Is that accurate or am I missing something?
No, you're spot on. Our job is to produce the best possible answers for the questions that we're asking.
Right.
And in order to get the funding largely from the federal government that we get for our programs, we have to compete with many, many other institutions. The chances of success for the proposals we submit are on the order of 10 to 20%. Our institute survives on how many proposals we can have accepted. And to do that, those proposals have to be absolutely top-notch. There's no way that politics in any way can be involved in that proposal or in the research that you do. And we're constantly trying to find better and better answers, find data sets that will allow us to reduce the uncertainty about future climate and to pin these things down. The very same can be said for literally, I believe, all scientists who are doing research. Research is the driver. It's understanding what the answer is. It has nothing to do with politics.
Well, can I ask a question
here?
Sure.
What's the order of things? Is it the government puts out a question and attaches funding to the question, or is the funding available first for a topic? How does that all work?
That's a very good question, and it depends which federal agency you go to. There are some federal agencies that have missions like NASA, and if NASA wants to go to Mars, they say, we want to go to Mars. We need to understand these things. We need to build something that allows us to go to Mars. The National Science Foundation, where we get the vast majority of our funding, doesn't have a mission. It doesn't have an agenda. They take the very best, based on a very detailed selection system, of the ideas that come in. And the direction that they go is driven by what is judged to be by not only reviewers who are fellow scientists, but by panels and by logistics constraints. In our case, what part of the world can you actually get to and collect ice? So it's always the best idea. I can guarantee you that if somebody wrote a proposal and said, I can prove that all of this stuff is junk, and the proposal was really scientifically sound, it would get funded.
Hmm. You know, Deb's question, I don't want to add my overlay to Deb's question, I think comes from the popular climate denial position, which is many of the researchers are trying to get funding. And so if the funding already has a point of view, then it almost taints the process because it's supporting a point of view. But Deb, if you have read, and I know you have your notes there, our guest background, Paul Andrew Majewski, director of UMaine, he's been doing this forever. He's been a leader of more than 55 expeditions to all over the world, Greenland Ice Sheet Project, Transantarctic scientific expeditions to 21 countries, 375 peer-reviewed publications. And this appearance here at Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, I know he will say it's one of the most special, but he's been on 60 Minutes, NBC, NPR, Nova, recently appeared on the Emmy Award-winning series Years of Living Dangerously. My point over years talking about this is folks like yourself and other people we've had talking about this are really focused on the science. You know, you don't go to Antarctic and freeze and go through this isolation if you're trying to just propose an agenda. And I don't want to spend too much time on this next kind of avenue of discussion, but how do we go from scientist and the overwhelming body of research, whether it's 97%, 96%, 98% of technical scientific research pointing to we have a real climate issue in the country, to it going from 130 members of the UMaine Climate Institute, where nobody, I'm guessing, has a real political agenda. You're just trying to do good work. How do we go from there to the perception that many people, many of them in the kind of conservative wing, many Republicans, disavow that and it becomes politicized? It's almost like competing views. Well, like, yeah, some people are talking about climate change, but maybe it's just weather. Why has this issue become politicized where it feels like it should just be about science?
That's, of course, that's the $64,000 question, is how do you manage to engage people? There are a lot of different answers. I think perhaps the most straightforward answer is to demonstrate to people on their local scale what is actually changing and how different it is now than it has been over the last few decades, and in some cases much longer, on the local scale. Because not everybody cares about every one of the consequences of climate change. But the two things that we do care about, of course, are our health and our wealth. And our health is severely impacted by climate change. We tend to think of climate change as only being warming, but it's not. With that warming come storms in some cases, and the frequency and the magnitude of storms changes because we're taking cold air and pushing it next to warm air. A simple way to think of it is warm air is getting pushed close to cold air in more places, so you have more turbulence. It's also a health issue because as you warm the climate, you begin to have more diseases that are migrating. In the case of Maine, Lyme tick disease is a classic example. It didn't exist in Maine before 2000, and now the number of incidences is increasing dramatically. And when we think about climate change, we, of course, think about greenhouse gases, CO2, methane, but there are a lot of other pollutants that go along with this, and there is no doubt we can demonstrate, you know, you can look at the emission records, but we can demonstrate how clean the atmosphere was 100 years or so ago, and their increased levels, some of them have been contained, things like lead, that's a great story. Sulfur in the atmosphere, it's a great story. Legislation did a wonderful job in leveling those things out, but we have increased levels of cadmium and mercury, several toxic metals, radioactive materials left over from the above-ground atomic bomb testing, particulates in the atmosphere that are small enough to get into the very smallest parts of your lungs. And so climate change, in my opinion, is a major, major security issue. It affects our health. It affects
the Pentagon has said it's one of the biggest, you know, people don't think of the Pentagon as being really connected to climate, but if the Pentagon is about our national security,
absolutely,
and it's going to affect water, which affects human behavior, which affects what's going on in the ocean with food and acidity.
Tens of millions of climate refugees.
Right. We had a guest on a few months ago, Dr. Lown, who is a Nobel Peace Prize winner down in Newton, Mass. and a really sharp gentleman, as most Nobel Peace Prize winners probably are, right, Deb?
Of course.
Because we don't have that many on. They really stand out.
Yes.
And he won the Nobel Peace Prize for inventing the defibrillator, mm-hmm. the DC defibrillator. He was a gentleman in his early 90s. And in the 60s, he was part of a group, Physicians Against Nuclear Proliferation, really had impact in terms of Cold War. And I was talking to him about nuclear disarmament and what's going on in Iran. And he was like, yeah, that's not our biggest threat. You know, a nuclear bomb goes off and it would be devastating and a million people could lose their lives. But the biggest by far threat facing the planet is climate. And we went into this whole discussion. But there's still 3 or 4% of people who claim themselves to be scientists. And they publish reports. They send them to the Koch brothers. They amplify it with $100 million of what mm-hmm. I call misinformation. But when you see one of these 3 or 4% scientists, and you go to, you speak all over the world, you travel all over the world, do you ever want to take them aside and go, Fred, Tom, Susan, whatever their names are, do you really believe this, or are you being contrary just for the sake of being contrary? How could a person go through a scientific background, to go through the whole academic, range of experience in biology and chemistry and geology? How could a scientist go through all that and then at the end go, yeah, I don't believe? Is it a suspension of reality, or how are those reports even being considered valid when everything seems so against it?
Well, I'll tell you, when I first started dealing with the community of skeptics 20 years ago, even up probably to 10 years ago, the first thing I would do is say, thank you. You've actually helped us to think more about things. You've raised questions, and as a consequence, we've perfected the science. We have answered the question even better, because they were pointing out things that the field was not as robust as it is now. Now it's really just a matter of being contrarian. So the role of contrarians in science is not necessarily bad. However, it's how much attention you pay to them. And when the contrarians begin to take pieces of sentences – in science, you never quote a sentence and then have a discussion about it. You typically develop a set of assumptions and a method by which you approach things. And when you take portions of sentences out of context, when you twist ideas, and they have whole books dedicated to doing this that many people look at, and they look impressive. They're produced just the way Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is, except they're basically full of junk. They're just bits and pieces of information. They'll show you part of a record, not the whole record. The problem is that they're taken too seriously. And the media, and I spend a lot of time with the media, and I have a great amount of respect for the media, but they shouldn't be given 50% of the discussion. They should be given 2% of the time for the discussion, because, in fact, they are in – to say they're in the minority is ridiculous. They're almost non-existent in
the science
world.
Yeah, there's a false equivalency. It's almost like, well, there's one side that believes this, one side right. believes that, but – my concern is that small percent, and I don't want to call them nut jobs, because what's better, wackos?
You're looking at me.
I'm not Deb. You know that.
No,
my concern is when these scientists who are wackos, they should get their scientific card taken away. Bill Nye should go on TV and him.
You sound like if there's 98% of a thought process on one side, that the 2% shouldn't be getting any airtime at all.
It's not thought process, Deb. It's science. That's the issue.
No, let's talk about NOAA and their mistake last year, saying 2014 was the warmest year on record ever, and then they had to back it up because in reality it was only 37% chance it was the warmest year on record. Talk about taking bits and pieces. It happens on all sides.
I don't know particularly about the Noah case.
Really?
I don't know if you do.
I don't know about it either, quite truthfully. No. And perhaps it is an embellishment of something that somebody found. Of course, there are mistakes made on any side, but the overwhelming evidence points to this. There is an answer. And in my mind, the answer is not to argue about what about the approaches as much as to provide the information to people and make it transparent. And that's exactly what we've done in our institute. We've developed software that allows you to see for the United States, using excellent data collected by EPA, exactly how the chemistry in the air that you breathe changes. Why is air important? Because if you have enough money, you can eat good food, you can drink good water, but you cannot escape the air that you live in. And the other software that we've developed, all publicly available on everything from your smartphone to the oldest laptop, is a program that allows you to see how the physical climate system has changed and see what the weather forecast is for the next few days. And weather and climate are integrally related. Just because it's an extremely warm day today, of course, doesn't mean that global warming is about to come down the pike, nor does a cold day say the same thing. You have to look at where it's warming, where it is in fact cooling. And in the Northern Hemisphere for the last 2 years, Eastern North America has been quite cool relatively. It's been extremely stormy. The length of the winter season hasn't necessarily been that long, but it's been cold. Last February, I believe, was the coldest on record for parts of eastern North America. You would look at that and you'd say, wow, it can't possibly be global warming coming. But if you take a look at this software that allows you to see the entire data set, you see the Arctic was unbelievably warm and the rest of the Northern Hemisphere was, in fact, warming. So why was eastern North America cold? It was cold because of the fact that the Arctic is so warm that the barrier that divides the cold air from the warm air, the westerlies that we use to fly from California to Boston, that weakened. And as that weakens, it allows more cold air to come south and more warm air to go north. And we ended up being, because of topography, in a place where the cold air came farther south. So the reason this may sound strange to people, but the reason for the cooling in eastern North America was because the Arctic was so warm. And the Arctic is very, very sensitive. It's a thin cover of ice, just a few feet. It's relatively easy to melt as you raise the temperature. And as you raise the temperature and melt that ice and allow the ocean to be exposed, the ocean is dark. It absorbs heat. The ice is cold. It reflects heat. So more ocean exposed, you get everything warming up, and you also release the heat from the ocean. The net result is we have this tremendous thermal imbalance in the Northern Hemisphere, which is pushing cold air farther south, warm air farther north, creating storms, cold air in some places, drought in California. And this is all a consequence of that thermal balance based on the fact that the Arctic is right now the most sensitive place to greenhouse gas warming.
Well, that doesn't sound strange at all. That sounds like science. Quick question, Deb, and then I want to get back into the science and the math.
Okay.
The question is, you would consider yourself of a conservative tribe, right?
Yeah.
Right. I would consider myself more independent thinking and
conservatives don't think independently. I love that.
Okay. Yeah, that was a subtle juxtaposition. But if a high percentage of Republicans lean towards not really believing or resisting climate change discussions, and a high percentage of Democrats or independents embrace science, why is there a political divide? Why would science, unless there was some ideology or some other variable, why would science be so clearly divided on this issue where most Republicans put it aside, whereas most Democrats support it? Why is it even political?
I think it stems, and I could be wrong, but my feeling is it stems from the Kyoto Treaty, that it's going to be such a big economic hit. That's why Republicans don't like it.
Is that why you don't like it? We can't speak for everyone, but how much detail do you know about Kyoto? How much detail do you know about the treaty that's impacted or that's driven your...
Well, it hasn't been instituted yet here, so we don't have a lot of detail on anything because it hasn't happened yet. But if it does, it is designed, in my opinion, to mostly take money out of our wallet. To do what? I don't think you can control the climate. Can we?
You can certainly reduce the amount of change that will occur.
But you can't control it.
That's Yes, in that way you are controlling it, because the things that control climate have never changed. What has changed is the rate in which things like greenhouses gases control climate, the rate at which ozone depletion in the southern hemisphere controls climate. So the process is exactly the same. We've basically taken climate and put it on speed. So if we're the ones who can raise greenhouse gas levels, then by lowering them or even stabilizing them, there will be that much less change in the future.
Okay, so that's man yes. affected. But the rest of the climate that's not affected by man, we have no control over.
We don't have
and
any.
And isn't that a bigger percentage?
No.
It's not?
No. The big things that control the climate system are where the Earth is with respect to the sun.
Right.
We cannot change that. That's for sure. But that's a very slow operating process, and it's very important, but it changes over thousands and thousands of years. It's the underpinning. The amount of energy from the sun, it changes. We have a solar cycle. But guess what? That solar cycle actually impacts climate through changes in the amount of ozone in the upper atmosphere, which protect us from incoming radiation. And we've actually destroyed a lot of ozone in the upper atmosphere,
yes.
In particular in the Antarctic. We've sort of basically involved ourselves in an awful lot of the mechanism by which the climate system operates and have been able to accelerate it.
We have Paul Andrew Maevsky here. He is director of UMaine Climate Institute, and he just refuted everything Deb said, which is always
always a good thing.
Sorry, Deb.
Like to celebrate that. Let's bring it back to Maine a little bit, because again, there's global impact, but Maine has its own unique climate, its own kind of unique physical properties as a state because of where we are in the ocean, where we are with our own unique topography, and where we are in latitude and longitude. What does climate change for people listening mean specific to Maine? I've heard and I've seen research on the impact of fisheries. You change the acidity levels in the ocean, and it just changes all of the marine biology from plankton up to the larger fish. And then there is, with warming, there is more ocean levels arising. Mm-hmm. We're seeing that. We're seeing the government prepare for it. We're seeing insurance institutes, planning boards are getting notices to literally change property lines all along shoreline and coastline all around the country, because what was once a fairly stable coastline, people are, you know, it's being predicted the next 50 years could change 10, 20, 30 feet. But what should people in Maine be immediately concerned about, or what effects can they see relative to the ocean and in terms of our actual climate?
Well, it depends where they live, as you already pointed out. Maine obviously is a big state, but actually, in terms of its climate, it spans, if you were to go to Europe, a significantly wider latitudinal range. We have relatively warm in the south, very cold in the north. We have a tremendous amount of coastline, so we're exposed to storms. This isn't necessarily the good thing in that way, but we're going to continue to have a great deal of precipitation. That's great. How often and when it comes, of course, is the more important thing, which there will be, as you get more precipitation, we can have more flooding. So we need to be very careful about how we deal with, for example, emerging urban centers and putting in the right amount of drainage. If the moisture comes in a warmer winter or it doesn't come in the winter, then it comes more as rain, then as snow, that can still lead to a great deal of ice on the roads. We will have changes in the sort of diseases that come up here. I spoke about Lyme tick briefly. We can expect changes in the fishing industry. Although trees react more slowly, it takes them many years to decades, we can expect changes in the amount of vegetation. The thing that is clear is that there will be change. There is no doubt about it. There is no model that suggests there won't be change. And the important thing is to understand what the change will be like in the place that you live. And that means thinking about your vulnerabilities in the town that you live in. If you live in a town in which the water handling systems and the sewers are very close to streams, which were never believed to get above a certain level. You need to think carefully about that. We have the opportunity to have renewable energy in this state with offshore wind power, onshore wind power, solar panels. If we're smart, we will be careful about how we put these things in compared to rebuilding an aging infrastructure. And the answer, I believe, will be that it is smarter to go to renewable sources of energy than it is to rebuild old systems. So we have great opportunities ahead of us in a place like Maine. You look at other parts of the world, and they're not going to have the opportunities we have. I'm in no way saying that warming is a good thing for Maine. I'm saying that we can pull, if we're smart, some good opportunities out of it. There are parts of the world that will have no opportunities. If you go to places like the Horn of Africa, West Africa, parts of Central America, the Middle East, if anything, they're going to go into more and more drought. There will be tens of millions of climate refugees that will need to go places.
Plus countries near sea level. I mean, there's all kinds of research.
The South Pacific Island countries. I believe there is already one country that has purchased land in another region in order to be able to move their population. Mm. So there are big, big things that are going to happen. These will impact all of us. I believe there's going to be a tremendous amount of in-migration to Maine in the next 10 years, certainly in the next 20 years. And that in-migration, it isn't necessarily going to come from climate refugees who are escaping developing areas. It's going to come from people in the other parts of the United States where they are subjected to drought, where the storms are even worse than we are, where they are subjected to rising tides and marine invasion. So Maine needs to think carefully how we go from very, very small urban centers by comparison with most of the East Coast of the United States and how we accommodate all of these changes.
Yeah, I was saying that yesterday. You weren't eavesdropping on my conversation yesterday, were you, Paul?
I try not to.
You try not to? By the way, we have Paul Andrew Majewski. He is the director of UMaine Climate Institute. And I was saying, Maine has a relatively weak economic engine for lots of reasons. We were one of the first settlements in the U.S. So we lack density and efficiency. We have 1.3 million people, over 35,000 square miles, 488 municipalities. So there's this old infrastructure that is too spread out, and the new economy really demands efficiency, density for healthcare, education, and jobs. But the thing we have is water, because we have a topography with mountains that accumulate snowfall, that melt, that go into streams. Everyone's familiar with Poland Springs water, but there's a huge water basin here in Maine. And at some point, when you read about the California drought and what's happening with agriculture, and I don't think it was intentional in Maine's part, because I don't think we're that forward-thinking, certainly not from our political leaders.
Certainly not.
They long-term planning is, what are we having for lunch?
Yeah.
What Maine has is open space. We have a reasonable climate that doesn't lend itself to year-round agriculture, mm-hmm. but enough of a decent climate that we can grow things. We have proximity to the ocean. We have one of the closest point-to-point ocean shipping lanes to Europe, which mm-hmm. was a big thing 150 years ago. We were one of the biggest shipping ports and boat-building centers in the country.
And through the opening Arctic.
And through which mm-hmm. people are saying is a future, as the Arctic opens up. But we have water. And so something as simple as water, which life depends on, is something we have in abundance. And if I was smart enough to figure out, I was saying this to somebody just last night, to buy some sort of future speculation on, I don't know if it's land or water rights, but I agree with what you just said, whether it's in 10 years or 20 or 30 years, Maine's deficiency and weakness is an economic kind of power, because we were dependent on natural resources and textile, and we've kind of missed the technology thing. We don't have enough people in close enough clusters. It may be like, I don't want to say it's like Mad Max or the apocalypse, but at some point, when going from the west to the east, they run out of water, Mm-hmm. Unless they figure out the whole desalination thing, which is very expensive and costly. But if you can, you know, get the salt out of the ocean water, there's certainly a lot of that. Maine could have a real future. But how could Maine think about that now and capitalize on that now? Or is it something that you think will just naturally evolve and we'll see how it goes?
I think that there are certainly people thinking about shipping through the Arctic and Europe into ports like places like Portland. We are seeing a tremendous increase in organic farming in greenhouses. So it's happening in places. Maine communities, based on what we understand about other parts of the country, are really becoming energized about what this change will mean to them. In many cases, they're worried. But once you begin to look at all of these things, yeah, we should be worried. But if you know what's in store for you, even if it's quite different than what you have now, if you prepare for it, you can have great opportunities as a consequence.
Interesting. We have Paul Andrew Majewski. He is a UMaine Climate Institute director. Have you ever been to Iceland?
I have.
I was just there a few weeks ago. And, you know, I'm looking at all of your trips and over 55 expeditions, and you've been all over the world, and certainly Greenland is getting a lot of attention because of the unique properties of how that's kind of melting away. But I went through the glaciers of Iceland, and there were areas where, and I was talking to a tour guide who I was with, who said, this gentleman was about 60, and he said, up until the last couple of years, he had never seen areas of rock, and it was always covered by ice. And when you're standing on top of a glacier in Iceland and you're looking down at rock and you can see over thousands of years where things have either eroded or the ice has retreated, and I looked at it and I said, this must be just thousands of years. And he goes, no, this is in the last 5 or 10 years. It is so profound. And Iceland itself, I'm not working for the Iceland Tourist Board, but they
but I could
because it was, parts of it look like Mars. Parts of it look like, in fact, I think some, you know, movies and some TV shows have used some B-roll of Iceland to simulate what Mars looks like. But that's the closest I've been to going on an expedition. So that's my long segue into, you know, you've been to Antarctic many, many times, and much of the research is being done there because it's the cleanest core samples, and that's where you have the longest, you know. What is, if you could describe either a recent or one that really stood out, when people hear about, oh, somebody went on an expedition to ice or to Antarctic, talk about what that's like, how hard it is to get there, what type of research is being done there, how long you've stayed there, to give an idea what these research projects and visits to like Antarctica are like.
There are a lot of different programs that are sponsored by the government, all coming through competed proposals. So you have biologists working along the coast because that's where the animals are. There are no animals inland. You have physicists working out of stations because the atmosphere is very thin. It's very clear, and they can see long distances into space. Our work actually takes us out onto the ice sheet, and I've traveled at least 20,000 kilometers over the Antarctic ice sheet on foot, on skis and snowmobiles and large track vehicles leading expeditions, and it's an amazing place. The ice, on average, is about 6,000 feet thick. The size of Antarctica, not counting the sea ice that surrounds it, is 1.5 times the size of the United States. There are no animals whatsoever once you get a few miles inland from the coast, other than an occasional insect, which is under a rock, probably one every few square feet. In the mountains that stick up above this ice. So some of these mountains are very high. It's a beautiful place. You have no perspective whatsoever of scale. You can look at something that you think is 50 feet away, and it might be the top of a mountain that's 200 miles away. You can literally see the curvature of the Earth. You can breathe more deeply than you can breathe anywhere because the air is so clean you just want to fill your lungs with it. And if in those times when the wind stops, if you just stand quietly out in the middle of Antarctica, you can hear your heartbeat in your ears. That's the loudest thing around.
Wow.
It's an amazing place. And we've spent, with my teams, we've been completely independent and traveling across the Antarctic ice sheet for up to 3+ months. We live in tents. Temperatures in the interior are close to minus 40 centigrade, minus 40 Fahrenheit is the same thing. Winds can be very strong. It's a challenging place. You can have crevasses, large holes in the ice that you've got to be – that you have to be able to maneuver around. The mountains are steep and high, and you are – it's just you and your team. In some cases, I've gone – I've had only one other person with me for 3 months. Other times, much larger groups.
How do you get to Antarctica? And is it this sounds like kind of a trivial, trite question, but not is it open to the public, but do you have to register as a research fellow? Is there an organization that kind of controls who is on the Antarctic, or could Deb book a flight and then just show up? And because until she sees it herself,
I got a lot of packing to do.
You've got a lot of packing to do. That minus 30 degrees,
yeah,
layering is so important. But I mean, technically, how do you? Is there one scientific organization that is kind of the gatekeeper to kind of control where people go and how transportation infrastructure is kind of set up?
To go to the continent, you need permission from your home country. It's international territory. Each home country is expected to oversee what its citizens do. You could if you had a sailboat, and we've gone by sailboat to the Antarctic. You can just land on the coast. There's nobody there to stop you.
Right.
The penguins don't have any particular customs agents. If you try to go to a station, it's more complicated. You need permission to go to the station. It is the only international territory on the planet, and it's really important to keep it that way. When we go, we either fly through New Zealand, and then typically from New Zealand, we'll get on a, for many years, operated by the Air National Guard and the Navy, we'd get on C-130s and fly, ski-equipped C-130s, fly to a station, and then from that station, we get our gear, and we might get flown farther inland, or we might just simply start going across the ice sheet from there. You can also go through South America and Australia. I've gone from South America to the Antarctic also. In relatively large vessels, 300 foot. And in fact, in October, we won't be going to the Antarctic, but we're going to one of the subantarctic islands, and we're going in a 72-foot sailboat because it's the only way you can get to that island and have permission to stay there very long if you have your own vessel with you.
Interesting. We have Paul Andrew Majewski here. Talk about, in the next few minutes, when people talk about yourself, talking about ice samples and why the Antarctic is such a kind of rich scientific platform, drilling down, you mentioned 6,000 feet, how thick the ice is.
In Greenland, yeah, 6,000 feet. That's average.
2 miles?
Well, 6,000 feet is a little bit over a mile. But there are certainly – that's just on average. There are places where it's well over 10,000 feet, so more than 2 miles thickness of ice.
So getting core samples, is it as simple as it sounds, where you drill down and depending on the depth, you're able to take samples up, and much like reading a tree ring, you're able to kind of carbon date or isotope date where that happened and then see what kind of carbon is in that layer from hundreds of thousands of years ago?
What we do is we're able to count down year by year. As a quick example, it's stormier in the winter and the spring there, so that means that you get more sea salt coming in during the winter and spring, less at other times of year.
So higher salt content means that was a seasonal.
Tells you a particular season. So we can count, we can identify the seasons and the years. You can count down year by year. You can calibrate that by looking for known volcanic events. You can use the atomic bomb testing to calibrate the upper parts. And then for each sample that we collect, and that might be one sample, 500 samples in a year, or it might be one sample in a year, there are well over 100 different measurements you can do that can tell you about past temperature, precipitation, sea ice extent, biological productivity in the ocean, which way the winds were blowing and where they came from, whether or not there are any human pollutants in that area, forest fires, volcanoes, solar activity, greenhouse gas levels. It's phenomenal. This ice in the right place and is the most robust indicator of how the environment has changed. There's nothing that captures the signal better than that.
That is fascinating. In the last minute we have, talk a little bit. It looks like the website where a lot of your work takes place is climatechange.umaine.edu.
Correct.
If you wouldn't mind talking about at UMaine, is there anything coming up or are there any projects? Or you mentioned the expedition in October where people listening who may have interest in climate or environmental studies should know about the work being done academically, or if somebody wanted to study or be part of this in some way, should they go to that website, or is there any other new things happening up there at UMaine relative to climate change?
It would be wonderful if they went to our website. There are a series of icons on the right side that tell you about the software we've developed. They can guide you to the expeditions that we have ongoing each year, and there are quite a few each year. They can tell you how to join our graduate program. They can give you for example, access to Maine's Climate Future. We wrote the first ever for a state document describing how climate change will impact Maine. That was in 2009. 2015, we wrote an update to that. You can download that update. You can find out how we interact with high schools. You can see the research that we've done. You can look at video, YouTube videos. The biggest thing that we're working on right now is something we call climate futures. It's an attempt to develop a framework which takes climate information, makes it transparent, and then allows people at a community or even national level to take a look at their vulnerabilities, see how those vulnerabilities will actually be impacted by these changes in climate, and then to do something which is done by both the military and businesses, but not necessarily by science, and that is to develop what are called plausible scenarios. What are the possibilities for the future? And we're concerned primarily about the next 20 to 30 years when most of us will be around.
Right. Well, I'd love to have you come back because I think this is an important, compelling issue, and really appreciate you coming in today. This has been fascinating. Right, Deb?
Indeed.
Deb, I think, has thawed a little bit.
I have thawed a little bit.
To use the vernacular, her entrenched stance seems like it's softening up, which I consider a win. And I think it's important information. I think it's another credit to UMaine and our university system in terms of doing work that's really interesting, that's impactful beyond just our state. And would love to have you come back sometime soon.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I really enjoyed it. Great questions, and I would be happy to come back again.
Great. That was Paul Andrew Majewski. For more information, go to climatechange.umaine.edu. You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM, WLOBradio.com. We'll be back next week. Thank you.